For those of you who didn't see it, Bex gave me like a really panicked, un-Anglican, I don't know what to say now look, but she did well. Well done. We'll make an Anglican out of you yet. Hi, my name's Amy, for those of you who don't know me. I am the curate here, and I will be taking us through our fourth mark of mission, which hopefully is going to appear on the screen now. So Bex couldn't remember this. Shocking. To transform unjust structures of society, to challenge violence of every kind and pursue peace and reconciliation. It's pretty big this morning, and we've got maybe like half an hour or so, including some discussion time. So what we're not going to do is you're not going to leave this place. Well, you might do. If you do, let me know, because then I should probably write a book on it. But, you know, we're not going to leave this place knowing all the answers of how we challenge unjust society. But I hope that you journey with me as we kind of explore a little bit about what this means and what this should look like for us as Christians. And for those of you who were here last week, I wasn't, but Matt spoke really well on the third mark, which is to respond to human need by loving service. And for me, this is the next logical step. So the sort of like loving each other needs to be at the heart of all we do to transform society. You only have to open a newspaper or look on the BBC News website at the moment to see that we are living in a time where society is unjust. We're living in a time just in this country where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. It's estimated that a third of the UK population fell beneath the official poverty line at some point between 2010 and 2014. That's just over 19 million people in our country fell beneath the poverty line at some point between 2010 and 2014. That's a shocking statistic I found out this week from the BBC News. And if you look further into the papers, you get stories about how there are inconsistencies with jail terms depending on where you were born, what colour your skin is, and how you were raised. You get stories about how women are still paid less than men for doing the same jobs. Society is broken. And I think we look around and we have no idea of where to begin. Last year, more than a million migrants and refugees crossed the border into Europe, sparking a crisis unseen by my generation before, and echoing the refugee crisis after the Second World War. Nearly 400,000 people were fleeing Syria. 200,000 people were fleeing the wars in Afghanistan. Of those million migrants, people were fleeing bombs and guns, and they are looking for safety. And the numbers haven't really dropped this year, with 135,000 people in the first 8 weeks of 2016 fleeing into Europe away from violence. Last year, nearly 4,000 died whilst they made the crossing over the Med as they tried to reach a place of safety. Now, last year, a number of us in the 20s and 30s group were watching all this unfold and were at a loss to know what to do. So we decided, as you do, to go off to Calais, to the jungle. The weekend we planned to go on was the weekend of the Paris, the November Paris attacks. So we kind of delayed for a little bit and went off in January. So this group of, I think there's 12 of us, or maybe 11, I've not counted, wait. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 11 of us. That is like 2:30 in the morning, which is why we're not looking particularly beautiful. We went off and we decided to go and spend the weekend in France, in the jungle in Calais. 30-minute journey through the Eurotunnel, and we hit such deprivation. These are the scenes that greeted us. And over the next 48 hours, we spent time with people who had been forced to flee awful situations that we couldn't even imagine. And this is where they ended up. In, honestly, the worst, dirtiest, most awful-smelling place I've ever been to in my life. Bex was there with me. She's nodding her head. And, you know, I've done some other mission-based trips, but Calais, the jungle in Calais, was just something else. And that was in January, so I actually dread to think what it would smell like now. The people I met were not looking for free handouts from the state. They were not looking for free medical health care, but they were looking to be in a place where they could get through the day without the fear of a bomb dropping on their head or without the threat of violence against their children. The people we met weren't running to Europe to try and get a nicer house. They were running to Europe because they thought they'd die if they stayed somewhere else. Chris Taylor, one of the guys who went out with us, had a really good chat with one of the guys he met. We've got no photos of the refugees or migrants that we met because there's a European law that once a refugee's been photographed in one country, they're no longer allowed to seek asylum anywhere else. So if there's a photograph of a refugee in France and the government get hold of it, if they apply for asylum in the UK, they can't get it, which in itself is just bonkers. As where do they come from? The sea. So Chris met this guy who had lived under threat. His life had been under threat under the Taliban in the 90s. So he moved to the UK, claimed asylum, won asylum legally, and lived his life here. He was a university lecturer. He brought his wife over. They had children here. He paid his taxes. He joined in with society. After a while, he decided he wanted to be part of the rebuilding of Afghanistan after the Taliban. So he went back. His life was again put under threat, and he moved his family around to try and keep them in that country but safe. And it didn't work, and they had to flee. So he escaped, but he's now a refugee sat in the camp in Calais, having been refused asylum into the UK. So he's stuck in that camp. He's an intelligent, well-educated man, a university lecturer. He's living in squalor. He's only there because the threat on his life and on his children's lives are so great. When we see the million migrants and refugees stats, it doesn't really mean anything, does it, until you are faced with people, until you look into their eyes and see their lives and understand that actually it would only mean a few things change in our lives to be in the same place. So we did that as a 20 and 30s group. And I know last week Matt shared the starfish story. The guy's walking down the beach and sees loads of starfish and he starts throwing them back in one by one and someone says, what good is that? You know, you'll never be able to do it all. But he says, well, it was good for that starfish and that starfish. And we came back, and there's a few of us here who went not really knowing if we'd done anything useful. But I think maybe we helped just a few starfish. And that's all God asks us to do sometimes. So on to Amos. Sorry it's taken me a while to get there. I wanted to share the stories of Calais with you. And first, a little bit of background to this prophet. Here's his icon. It's very shiny. That's what happens when you type in Amos into Google Images. So I thought I'd share rather than just having a white background behind me. People aren't really sure what he did. He was either a farmer or one who looked after sycamore trees, as you do. He lived in about 760 BC. He lived in Judah and then left his home in Judah to go and prophesy over Israel, which at that time was split into the north and southern kingdoms. The book of Amos is really short and a really good read if you're ever in the mood for a little bit of a minor prophet. Amos kind of lays into Israel a bit, actually. He has a word from Yahweh, so from God. Israel is at that moment thinking that she is so much better than all the other nations around her. She thinks that she can go it alone and doesn't need any help from anybody. Amos is like, what are you talking about? Of course you need unity and you need other people. He in fact says to her as a nation, he says, Israel, you bear even greater responsibility because you are God's chosen people and you have God's place in you have a place in God's heart. So Israel is kind of kicking back, thinking they're doing all right, and they're not. Amos talks about the lack of care of others in Israel and how Israel ignores corruption that's going on inside the nation. The book ends with a promise, though, a bit of hope, as lots of these minor prophets do, that the remnant of Israel will be returned and restored to God in time. So if you want to open your Bibles that you got earlier and turn to Amos 5, then this would be the time to do that. I'm not sure what the page number is, I'm afraid. It's kind of, if you head towards the Gospels and then go back a little bit, you'll find the minor prophets. So the day of the Lord is talked about in this prophet, in Amos. But this is the first passage, the first verse it's talked about. It says, "Woe to you who long for the day of the Lord. Why do you long for the day of the Lord?" The day of the Lord, unsurprisingly, talks about, it's about the day when the Lord is coming back. He's coming back to proclaim victory. He's coming back to establish his rule over all nations. So the day of the Lord is the day when every knee will bow before him. Now, it's clear from the rest of the book, and hopefully some of what you know about Israel, that most of Israel are looking forward to the day of the Lord. This will be a good day. The Lord will come back and he will put us back in our rightful place. This is the day that has been prophesied for years. But Amos declares it will not be good news for Israel, necessarily. He declares it will be darkness, not light. Amos is calling to Israel. He's almost shouting at them, "Why do you not see what is going on in front of you, Israel? All is not actually as well as you think it is." But why will the day of the Lord not be good for Israel? Amos has explained a few verses before the passage we look at. This is what he says, the beginning of chapter 5. If you can read that or look in your Bibles. Beginning of chapter 5 says, "Hear this word, Israel, this lament." Just go to the lectern mic. Great, thank you. "Hear this word, Israel, this lament I take up concerning you. There are those who turn justice into bitterness and cast righteousness to the ground. There are those who hate the one who upholds justice in court and detest the one who tells the truth. You levy a straw tax on the poor and impose a tax on their grain. There are those who oppress the innocent and take bribes and deprive the poor of justice in the courts. Therefore, the prudent keep quiet in such times, for the times are evil." Amos exposes the heart of Israel. And the heart that he sees is corruption and smugness. Israel thinks that she's doing all right with God. Her sacrifices are being kept up, the festivals are being sorted out. And she hopes that that's enough to keep God happy. But Israel is far from being right. So verse 21 says, I despise your religious festivals. Your assemblies are a stench to me. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps." These are really cutting words against Israel. I think we even get that in the English translation. This isn't meek and mild, "Israel, you're messing around a bit, stop it." This is really strong. The words in Hebrew means that God cannot stomach the hypocrisy. The words that he uses in Hebrew are like, "The stench of your religiousness is just offensive to me." They're abusing the worship. "Your worship and your ritual are just empty and mean nothing." And why is that? Because outside the temple, they are generally being a really quite dreadful people. They are unfairly taxing the poor. They're bringing corruption into court. And the worst thing is that the majority of Israel are keeping silent about this. Religion means nothing to God, but relationship does. Israel are going into their temple and they're making the right sacrifices and they're doing the right thing. But they're not having a heart for anybody else. They're not caring for their neighbour. They're not seeking to bring justice in a society. But they think they're doing okay. And this prophecy from Amos is like, "Israel, you are not doing okay. You have to stop and look around your society and see what is happening." It's almost like, get your head out of the religious stuff and get into the stuff outside, the real stuff. Because God is all for relationship, and he's all for relationship with us and us with him. That's what he loves. But he's not about empty offerings and empty sacrifices. And I've been thinking a lot about that this week. What do we do with that? I don't really know. So as I said earlier, we're living in a time when in this society the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Where people who suffer disabilities are being penalised for just having those disabilities. When people are still facing racism in the workplace and in the social sphere of life. One of God's problems with Israel was the people who sat back and just watched and said nothing. There's that famous Holocaust poem, isn't there, that reflects something of that attitude. So first they came for the communists, and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews. I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was nobody left to speak for me. I'm obviously not saying we're in a time of Holocaust, but I think we're in a time when some people need a voice that others have and they might not have. And I think we're in a place as people who love Jesus to be able to do that for other people. So verse 24 is the hope at the end of that passage. It says this: let justice roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-ending stream. Essential to the lifeblood of Israel is justice. And by ignoring it, Israel, you're leading yourselves down a path which leads to death. Because justice and righteousness are essential to the life and faith of Israel. What Amos is saying is that those who seek to bring praise and glory to God in his name must uphold his character as well as his name. Indeed, not just in words. For God, faith without works is dead. But social justice without the fire and passion of faith is no good either. Like Matt was talking about last week, we do all this stuff because we know God loves us and he loved us first. And out of that love, we are compelled to go out and help people. This passage in Amos is about how God is desperate for people to challenge the unjust nature of society. He's desperate for them to step out of their temple and go and look outside and see what's happening. Now, because it's an S2 service, we're going to have sort of 5 minutes or so for you guys to turn around and have a chat with your neighbour about your thoughts on this subject and this passage. So here are some questions to start you off. So the first question: are you surprised by how harsh God is when he speaks to Israel? What do you think he would say to us on the subject? Where in our society do you see corruption and injustice? And question 3, what can we do about it? So until about 15:15, if you want to turn around in pairs or in small groups, or if this completely freaks you out, you feel very free to do this by yourself in your head. But let's try and get some conversation going about what we can do as Christians in this state. So till 15:15. Go. Okay, can we bring these conversations back together? Brilliant. So I hope that you've talked about it and have all the answers and what we can do about, you know, an unjust society. Again, if you have, let me know and we'll write a book together, because that, you know, will bring us in millions of pounds, I'm sure. I'm sure everyone would want to know. I'm going to talk a little bit now about what practically we can do about injustice. Last week, we were in Washington, D.C., which was fun, on our honeymoon, which was fun. There was, like, lots of, you know, museums and stuff, and I... Thank you, David. I kept going on the museums for, like, my 2.5 hours was about the length of time that I could deal with it. Whereas Femi loves the museum, so he just kept going. It was awful. Wonderful. Anyway, so we let loads of history stuff, not obviously, like, real old history like we have here, but sort of, like, semi-old history. But, like, a lot of it was about the black civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. And one of the things that stuck with us is we saw... in a museum, this lunch counter. This lunch counter was from an F.W. Woolworth store in North Carolina. It was from the 60s. This was a time when segregation was still legal in America, and this was a whites-only lunch counter. On February the 1st, 4 African-American students, those 4, went in and were denied service and were asked to leave. But they stayed seated. They returned and they sat in those same seats for months. And over the next 6 months, hundreds of students and church members across the US walked into whites-only lunch counters and also sat down. These people were spat on, had food thrown at them, and were basically bullied by anybody who walked in to those lunch counters who didn't agree with what they were doing. It took them 5 months, and that particular fight was won. All of the lunch counters in about half of the shops in America became meant so anyone could sit down and eat their lunch there. Civil rights leader James Farmer said this of those boys: with their very bodies, they obstructed the wheels of injustice. But it would be another 4 years of struggle before the passing of the Civil Rights Act, which banned segregation everywhere. And if we're honest, I think we'd be naive to think that race is no longer a factor in America. This is sort of not that long ago, in the 50s and 60s. Life is better than it was, but is it the best it can be? And we see this stuff all around us, don't we, that makes us mad and just really cross. But what can we do? Because if you're like anything like me, you just feel useless, completely useless. And this quote has been in my head this week: never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And for me, if we add faith into the mix, then what can stop us? Because I seem to remember there being a verse about faith as big as a mustard seed being able to move mountains. Wilberforce, in the top right, had to bring the act to end slavery before Parliament 9 times before it was voted. Most of these times, it didn't just lose the vote, it was actually laughed out of Parliament. Rosa Parks remained seated when others would have stood up and given in. Nelson Mandela spent years in jail and came out with a dream not to destroy the country that had put him there, but to rebuild it and renew it. Mrs. Pankhurst fought to have the right to be viewed equally to men in voting rights. Bonhoeffer stood up to the Nazis because of his love for Jesus and died because of it. Because standing up for what is right may at best lead to ridicule, and at worst, if we're honest, lead to death, and lots in between. But before us have gone a great cloud of witnesses, and the testimony of these people, the power of the word no, and the persistence of faith shows us that social change is possible. So what can we do? Well, I think we have to admit that politics and faith are actually intrinsically linked. And there's a time, though, when politics cannot solve situations. And this is the time where social movements with Jesus at the core and at the center, need to rise up and to stand up and say, no, enough is enough. We as Christians need to not be afraid to speak up and speak out for other people. We need to pray, and we need to be the ones who bring the light of Jesus into dark places. And scarily, that can mean leading the charge of change. And we do all this because we love Jesus and because he has loved us first. In a moment, we're going to share communion together. But before we do that, I want to just share one final story, if I may. This is a book by a guy called Jim Wallace, who is just ace. If any of you want to read some really good, thought-provoking Christianity and politics stuff, he's the way to go. So some years ago, on a trip to England, this is Jim Wallace speaking. Some years ago, on a trip to England, I walked through the historic Holy Trinity Church on Clapham Common in South London. This Anglican parish was Wilberforce's home church, where he wrote Britain's anti-slavery legislation. The rector was very proud to show me round, and on the walls were pictures of typically English-looking gentlemen who had helped turn this country upside down. Finally, the rector pointed to an old, well-worn table. "This is the table upon which William Wilberforce wrote the Anti-Slavery Act," he said proudly. "We use this table every Sunday for communion." And I was struck here, in a deep liturgical symbol, that the secular and the sacred are brought together with powerful historical force. Because how can we ever separate the sacred and the secular? On this table, the slave trade was outlawed, and the body and blood of Christ is celebrated each week. Because what becomes of religion that believes its duty is to change society on behalf of justice? That is when religion flourishes. The blood of Christ is poured out in communion for us to take. It's up to us to go out and take that into the world and bring justice everywhere.